eyes. Like, I'm going to find housing when I'm there. Like, I'll figure it out. So I booked an Airbnb.
So you got to Wellington without housing lined up?
I was like, I gotta figure this out. And that was a huge lesson on adversity and problem solving, because I was like, I've been here 2 weeks and I don't have a place to live.
Welcome to the Near and Far podcast. I'm your host, Zachary Ellis, and this show is all about embracing curiosity, leaping beyond your comfort zone, and learning from adventurers like yourself who have traveled near and far. We're joined today by our guest, Marina Steiner. Marina has established a fulfilling career in global health, and she's an example of someone who demonstrates how a life of travel can be attainable with the right mindset. Her work has taken her to Nepal, Uzbekistan, New Zealand, and beyond. So welcome to the show, Marina.
Thanks for having me, Zach. Happy to be here.
Nepal, how old were you the first, I guess, the only time you went to Nepal?
I was 19 and I turned 20 while I was there. It was my first birthday in a different country, actually. So that was a one to remember.
Wow.
It was really exciting to do that with some friends and colleagues.
All right. I didn't realize it was your first birthday in a different country. What was your birthday like in Nepal?
Yeah, I think it was a transit day. So we had a pre-scheduled plan and program that we were, I want to say we were driving back from the village that we stayed in and headed back to the capital, our home base in Kathmandu. So it was a kind of a transit day. I know it was a long bus ride. Folks were sick, plenty of stops. It was fine. I can't completely remember, but I'm sure we went out to get dinner that night. But that's quite all right, because I got to see a lot of the countryside from the bus that we traveled through.
Nice. What brought you to Nepal in the first place?
Yeah, so when I was an undergraduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I really caught on to the Global Health Certificate right away. There was a class I took my first semester freshman year. It was NutriSci, but I absolutely loved it and the applications to global health, and right away decided I wanted to do that certificate. There are field experiences you could do for your certificate, so I started looking at the pre-offered programs, and there was one that looked at health and health disparity between urban and rural health in Nepal. Some of them were focused more on food systems, the different programs. Others were focused maybe on specifically like vaccination clinics or something like that. And I like this one because it was looking at the disparities and sort of kind of a big picture health thing. Because I knew I wasn't going to, you know, for example, be a doctor. That wasn't in my plan, but I wanted to understand indicators of health. So I applied for that program and I got in. So in May and June of 2018, myself and a few other classmates that I didn't meet until the pre-orientation trip, I'll travel to Nepal. I think there were about 15 of us, I want to say. And we spent 3 weeks there. We partnered with Teach for Nepal, who's the director, did his master's at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And then he went back to Nepal and created the Teach for Nepal program. So we partnered with them and got a really great experience of being able to see health systems across the country.
Oh, that's cool. And as a 19-year-old, when you first landed in Nepal and you were there with a bunch of people you had just met, what was going through your mind in that moment?
It was my first time traveling solo, because I stopped in Europe on the way there because I had some friends traveling, and then went to Nepal, and that navigating the flight and the layover in the Qatar airport and into Nepal, I was alone because we all flew in at different times. Some people went traveling earlier. I knew I had to get through customs and then get picked up by a taxi with their organization, and I just remember going through customs and being kind of like in more of an open air airport. And that was so strange to me, and how it was so much smaller and it wasn't like white marble, kind of how US airports are very sterile, I guess you could say. Like, not saying that this one was dirty, but they want to seem very spaceship kind of esque and so forth. And this one had so much more like homey character to it. And that was really neat. And I remember being really scared to go through customs, because that was my first time doing it by myself. And sometimes you hear like silly stories about customs or whatnot, but it was completely fine. And then we get in the taxi and I was just looking around, and it was just like, oh my gosh, there are so many people, so many different kinds of cars and trucks and scooters. And it was all at once.
Wow. Yeah. That seems quite overwhelming. I also grew up in the Midwest, and you don't realize just how homogenous some of our towns and small cities are until you end up in a completely different environment.
Absolutely. And it made me appreciate so much through my travels of how rich and diverse places can be, and with coexistence among so many people. It's been really great.
You were there to study the disparities between urban and rural divides. How did you split your time? Were you in the cities for a few days before venturing off on a bus, or?
Yeah, that's exactly it. We spent, if I remember right, the first week we spent in Kathmandu, the capital, and we went to see a private hospital versus a public hospital, so one you pay for versus you don't pay for. And that was really interesting to see, you know, the disparities of wealth and access to healthcare just through that. We also went to an eye clinic. We went to an Ayurveda, which is kind of a holistic medicine clinic. We went to like a sex trafficking awareness sort of organization meant to help out young kids, and a couple other places like that. And then the next week, we spent about 5 days in a village, a small village up on the near the Annapurna Trek. And so we looked at the healthcare there, and it took a whole day to get there between the bus to the jeeps. Then you had to finish the trek on foot. And so it was really interesting to see the access to healthcare and just understanding, hey, if there's a medical emergency, this is how much it would take to get to the nearest, like, city hospital, for example. And looking at the health clinic and the access there and the shamans that would take care of the village folks, and just making you really appreciate the rich life there and understanding to respect how things function in some of these small rural places, and they do the best with what they have. And at the same time, realize that access to healthcare is such a privilege, and they do what they can, and it can be scary, you know, out there. So that's what we did the second week. And then the third week, with some transit days, of course, I think we spent about 4 days in the village, which is wonderful. We got to stay with a family and a young girl, and it was really nice, and they were so welcoming. And then the third week, we did some fun stuff, so we went on a trek.
Nice. What was the most notable observation that you had about the different healthcare options there? I assume airlifting is out of the question for most people.
Yeah. There are some really rural villages, and I don't think there'd be a place to land because you're up in these crazy mountains. I mean, you could try to land in a field, but I don't even know if there'd be connection to the hospitals there, if I'm remembering right. One thing I noticed was in the village, we looked at the birthing clinic, and understanding that there's, you know, someone's not there staffed full time. It's if something happens, and then you call folks and connect folks through the grapevine to get whatever resources or doctors or nurses there to help for a childbirth. So it's not staffed full time, one, because it doesn't need to, maybe, you know, because there's less people. But if someone's gone, then you're kind of, that could really affect the health outcomes of a birth, for example. And that one really hit home for me. If someone's in a dire situation, it's not like all the resources are centrally located.
And it's not like that's the kind of thing that you can really time.
Yes, exactly. And if, you know, if something happened with the births, which happens sometimes, and it's like, okay, what would that look like if they needed more care than what was able to be provided at the village doctor? So
what healthcare options would have been available to you and if you or one of your colleagues needed something?
Yeah. At the village, you know, we really made sure to stock up on, you know, having some medicines on us. There is an outbreak of pink eye or something among a couple people, and we had to stop at a pharmacy, not in the village, but in a different town before our trek. This was in Pokhara, and trying to communicate, we needed eye drops of some sort, and, like, you know, can't get a prescription. So that was, and of course there's a language barrier, right? I don't speak Nepali. And so just kind of trying to use Google Translate or talk about that or go with someone like our friends that teach for Nepal to help translate that.
An experience that you were pretty embedded in was staying with that host family for a few days. Was there also a language barrier there, or were you and your host family able to connect?
There was a language barrier, and I think the young daughter, she was about high school age, and she's the one who kind of cooked with us and brought us to the school each day to do our work with the community. And, you know, we learned about the school, a little bit of the education system, and got to chat with the kids, which was really fun. But with the father and the mother and the other young kid, we couldn't communicate. So the daughter kind of helped us. And it was just a lot of you know, hand motions, smiling, yes, no, and being polite. And it's really amazing how well you can communicate when you need to, and just finding out ways to talk about what you need and where to go. And she knew some English, which was nice. And I remember distinctly on the side wall of the school, there outside painted was the Nepali alphabet along with the English alphabet. And I think it was the English alphabet first in order with the Nepali script next to it. So I thought that was interesting. And I think that's a big part about rural education, is teaching these young kids English so that, you know, to help bring opportunities. And it's one of those things, again, where you're like, oh my gosh, we're so lucky that at least English is my first language. And so generally speaking, I don't have issues traveling. Have definitely been challenged in that though, but we're so privileged to be able to speak English, since, you know, this village out in very rural area of Nepal are teaching it to their kids. So
I don't think most people realize just how abundant English is throughout the world. You can go to, it's the universal language of aviation, so any airport in the world will have some people who know English. I'm curious about the food that they were cooking while you were staying with your host family. What's Nepal village food like?
My favorite. Okay, so they made homemade French fries, like a potato, and you put in a pan. And what's really interesting is we're in this very terraced field, so there's a lot of agriculture in the village, and it's these big terraces up on the side of the mountainside, and you're in this very steep valley, and it's so green and lush, and they grow so much food. And just like the food system is like, they still use plow and ox, and so there'd be people who were taking their oxes out, with like the wooden like backhoe behind them plowing the fields. And so that was really interesting to see that part of the food system to grow. And then in the home is the older daughter is one who cooked for us, and they have like their kitchen area inside, but then out a back door and with a little lean-to that's connected to the house is the kitchen where they actually cook, and it's a fire. And I remember a lot of these people, you know, they cook over wood-burning fireplaces to cook. But indoor smoke inhalation from cooking is a huge issue for young women and girls in a lot of these, you know, more isolated countries and regions, because they're, you know, leaning over smoke all day. And so, you know, there's some efforts to bring in, you know, maybe like a stove, your Coleman camp stove, to help, you know, reduce deforestation or help with health outcomes. But at the same time, it's like, you can't just introduce this Western idea of cooking into these cultures. Those require resources and gas that they don't have. And so it's just like how to balance out some of those two considerations that trying to have in terms of improving health outcomes, but understanding the culture. So there she was cooking over a big fire all day, and to cook for us, it was because they didn't have electricity, right? So that was interesting. But she made potatoes. But my favorite thing, I have to look at the pictures. My favorite was Tibetan bread. It was so good. It's like a pan-fried bread, and it had two slices down the middle as a circle. And it was just, it was like basically like fried bread, but it was so sweet at the same time. Oh my gosh, that was my favorite. That's my absolute favorite. So that's what we had in the village.
That sounds really good. And that's such an excellent point about bringing in resources like propane to cook healthily. Like, Even using a gas stove indoors, like, you're not getting like the worst of smoke or anything. It burns so cleanly. And yeah, that's just such a different lifestyle.
Absolutely. And it's something we chatted about a lot, because we were looking at these urban and rural health disparities. So it's like these young women and children and girls who are cooking in these rural areas, that's a health disparity, is that they can't cook with electricity. So that's one thing that stuck with me. I learned.
So is the solution running power lines? Is the solution within the scope of... I know it's not within the scope of what a 19-year-old turned 20-year-old is doing in Nepal. Is this even within the scope of what you're doing now?
No, it's not quite in the scope of what I'm doing now, but it's a great question. It's something I think about a lot in terms of whenever we look at improving conditions for communities who have health or economic or resource challenges, is like, understanding where to meet them in the middle versus coming in with a preconceived idea of what's going to be the solution. And I think that's something really critical that I've learned a lot in my role right now with the international work that I'm doing. And so the solution for each of those villages, I think it has to be a case-by-case basis on what input the community wants. You know, you could take years doing economic analysis and health analysis to figure that out. And I'm sure there's places all around the world that have gone each way in terms of that. But I think education would be my best neutral kind of way to go forward. Be like, hey, this is something that can be really affected to your health and inhaling smoke all the time. And, you know, how can that be modified without modifying their cooking mechanisms? But just letting folks know, you know, how to do it maybe in a more safe manner.
On that note, let's come back in a few moments and we'll talk about some other parts of the world. Whether we've inspired you to add a new place to your bucket list or gave you helpful tips for getting there, leaving your review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify is one of the best ways you can help other listeners find episodes like this one. Thanks in advance, and now back to the show. Marina, what brought you to New Zealand? You were still an undergrad, right?
I was still an undergrad, yeah. So that was my next big international trip after Nepal, and I knew I still wanted to study abroad. And technically Nepal was a study abroad, but I was like, I want to go for more than 3 weeks to somewhere. And I just feel like everyone was going to Europe, not to shame on Europe, but I want to do something a little different. And so two of my cousins studied abroad in New Zealand and absolutely loved it and encouraged it so much. So I looked at programs, and my undergrad university had a program in New Zealand, and I could choose from one of three campuses to do partnering projects or to do my studies at. And one was in Auckland, which is a major city. The other one was in Palmerston North, which is more of like a rural agricultural place. That was where the environmental science program was, which is where I should have taken classes because I was an environmental science major. But no, I wanted to go to Wellington, the capital city, because I wanted to live near things and like experience culture and people and museums and art. So I went to the Wellington campus of Massey University, and they're mostly known for their art. So I took a few fun classes while I was there, including communications and painting and things like that. So that brought me to New Zealand. I think it was just a word of mouth and the itch to travel again. I knew, I can't remember how intimidated I was by the language factor again, but I knew it wouldn't be an issue in New Zealand.
Right, because most people there are English speakers.
Mm-hmm.
There is a really cool movement to re-embrace the Maori culture, the indigenous culture there. At least when I went, there were Maori words everywhere that I looked.
Mm-hmm.
Though English was the predominant language. I'm curious, were any of the fun classes, did they have any elements of Maori culture? Did you learn Maori painting techniques?
Not so much like focus on the culture, is more interwoven with the day-to-day. So all the signs at parks that I was, because I did a project on invasive pests, I think, or conservation. Yeah, I did a conservation project for one of my classes to tie in some environmental stuff. And the Maori words were mostly like on the park signs as well. You're starting to see that in the US too, where it has like the English word of the park, and sometimes underneath below I'll have whatever local tribes' languages and what they call the park. And they had all of that in Maori in New Zealand all over the place. So I definitely saw that culture interwoven with the day-to-day. I distinctly remember I was there, it was March 2019, and that is when the Christchurch shooting happened, which was the first time that, you know, New Zealand had such a mass shooting like this. And I remember it was really spooky because it was very new to all these people, and you kind of felt the weight of the country there, the devastation, you know, since that's nothing like that has ever happened in New Zealand before. And I distinctly remember watching the funeral services, you know, post-event services there, and Jacinda Ardern, the prime minister at the time, she wore the Maori traditional robes at this ceremony. And that was just like, I was like, I've never seen that by any sort of political leader. It could have happened, like, don't get me wrong. But I thought that was a really core memory. And I think I have a picture of it on the TV because I thought that was a really great gesture of incorporating the culture into this, the ceremonies they do by the government. Yeah.
So I'm going to take a pretty large pivot because we could go on to all sorts of tangents regarding
yeah.
that and how different the reaction in the U.S. is when a similar tragedy happens. So where did you stay as a study abroad student? Were you in the dorms?
Yeah, absolutely. I did not want to do the dorms because they're expensive. So I was like, I'm going to find housing when I'm there. Like, I'll figure it out. So I booked an Airbnb.
So you got to Wellington without housing lined up?
I had a week lined up at an Airbnb. So, but technically, yes. And so I was up in this hillside, like a half hour, 45 minute walk up into the valley, staying with this woman at Airbnb, and I booked it for a week. And I was like, all right, I'll find housing. So I remember getting on the flat house search on Facebook right away to try to find somewhere I could sublease. And I remember distinctly before I left, but I was like searching on Facebook, trying to find like for like lineup housing and tours. And I made like a Facebook post in the housing page. And I was like, preferably, you know, this is me. I'm a study abroad student from the US, yada, yada, so forth. Looking for preferably like upperclassmen, meaning like juniors or seniors. I was a junior in college at the time. Posted it, and then right away people were like, upperclassmen, who does she think she is, like looking for these wealthy people, yada yada, so forth. So it's not that
that's
was like
a big misunderstanding.
Yes, exactly. Even though it was English to English, it was just like contextualized misunderstanding. And I just remember being so embarrassed and defeated. I was like, everyone's gonna think like I'm snotty and that's not what I meant. I just need a place to live. Oh my gosh, the tears that happened on that. It was really funny. So needless to say, the housing search continued. I ended up staying, not doing house flat searches, and it was just really hard. And I ended up staying in a hostel my second week. And when classes started, staying at a hostel, that was, yeah.
So did you get any sleep that week or?
No, because I was really cheap and went in like a co-ed 12 person to a bedroom hostel and with all of like my gear for like 4 months. And it was fun.
Did the other 11 guests let you do homework? Did they quiet down? Or?
I did. I was mostly apartment searching out of my bunk. But yeah, it was really weird. But I was like, I got to figure this out. And that was a huge lesson on adversity and problem solving. Because I was like, I've been here 2 weeks and I don't have a place to live.
I don't think there are a whole lot of people who would just go to another country for 4 months without knowing where they're going to stay. That's brave.
Yeah, I must have got a word through mouth of just like finding a flat or something, because I really don't know why I made that decision to figure it out when I get there. I must have had some sort of like intel that it would all work out.
Well, where'd you end up?
Yeah, I ended up at a flat just down the flats and apartments, what they call in New Zealand, just down the road from the university with someone who worked there and this other couple. And they were a bit older than me at the time, but I was like, they're like, yeah, we need someone to fill this room. It's like, great. So I bought a mattress, a twin mattress, and a small desk from the Salvation Army, had them delivered, and I just slept on a mattress on the floor in a bare room for 4 months. It was great.
I mean, yeah, you're not there for the accommodations. You're there to explore New Zealand.
Exactly. And minus accommodations, it was a little chilly. It's definitely, the houses are not very well insulated, I will say that. And got a bit cold. But yeah, I was traveling most weekends anyway, so I was like, all right, I just need a place to crash.
There's kind of a feeling that everything in New Zealand is familiar. It doesn't feel like you're in the opposite corner of the world, because everyone speaks English. You see a lot of the same brands that you'd see, the same fast food chains that you'd see in either the US or Western Europe, because colonized New Zealand, so you see a lot of British brands, and I can definitely see how it lulls you into a sense of familiarity, and you forget that a word like upperclassman is going to cause so much havoc.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is that learning curve, and I remember taking, I think, the bus from the airport into town and being actually, even though it's familiar, like I could read the English, the infrastructure looked different to me. It's not what I expected. It seemed a little bit...
It's nicer than ours.
I was going to say it felt older, but maybe that's the part of town I was going through on the hillside, and I was like, huh. But it's also on the coast, so maybe it's like the salt water and air kind of those things. I don't know. It's a beautiful city, though. Absolutely. Like, that was just one of my first glances at like a side neighborhood. Yeah, the lingo part was definitely a learning curve. And between Australia and New Zealand, they kind of have a fun competition of like, what is the other person saying? What do these slang words mean? Because between those two countries, and you never compare them if you're talking to a Kiwi or an Aussie, can never put them together in the same sentence. They're distinctly different. But from an outsider, it's like, there's just a lot going on.
Yeah, you're both off in that southern place. If I've gathered anything from our conversation so far, is that you're someone who is comfortable with being uncomfortable.
I think by default that you have to be for the places I find myself in. Yeah, I like adventure. I like things that are new and figuring things out. It's kind of like a puzzle. I'm a science person. Maybe it's just all a puzzle for fun, is the way I see it.
What's the most puzzling trip you've ever been on? What was the most curious? No, what was the, I don't know, where do you want to take this?
Yeah, I would say, yeah, the most challenge I've been, can spin back to when I was most language challenged was last summer, 2024. I was in Uzbekistan for about 3-ish weeks. And I was in a region called Kyrgyzstan, the Republic of Kyrgyzstan. It's in the western part of Uzbekistan. And that was the most language challenge I've ever been. And thinking about, you know, going to Europe, most people speak English as well because it's very touristy. And that's how it is. Australia, New Zealand, English is the first language. Places I've been in Latin America, you know, I speak some Spanish. And I took that as a kid. And they also speak English a lot of times. But Uzbekistan, it was not the case, which is completely fine. And they speak 3 languages in Kyrgyzstan, if not more. So it was a lot. I relied on Google Translate a whole lot, taking pictures of the menus, letting them load. And sometimes even the translation, I remember sometimes on the menu, it said fire hydrant. We're like, what's a fire hydrant on your pizza? Like, and it happened a couple times. So the translation was just completely not great. And
is
so
it
sometimes
spicy or
I don't know. I couldn't tell you what the fire hydrant was on the pizza. By the time I ordered, I'm like, I forgot. The food came out. I'm like, I forgot what I ordered anyway. Like trying to go through the menu. So that was definitely puzzling in terms of navigate the train system and restaurants and buying stuff at the bazaars and working with our partners in country. Thankfully, we had some really great translators and partners that were already established to do the work. So that helped it. But it was still something. It was good. It was uncomfortable, but a good uncomfortable.
So many places to go, so many things to see. Wherever you are, make it easy to find more interviews like this one. Near and Far's free monthly newsletter will keep you up to speed about the latest podcast episodes, as well as our hand-picked recommendations. That's only 1 email per month. To sign up, simply follow the link in the show notes or head over to www.nearandfar.travel/newsletter. What are the 3 languages that are spoken in Kyrgyzstan?
Yeah, so in Kyrgyzstan, they speak Kyrgyzpak. It's a regional language, native language to this culturally distinct region. Kyrgyzstan has its own language, flag, it's its own republic. They also speak Uzbek because it's located in Uzbekistan. So that's a lot of language used to report to the other parts of the country. And then they also speak Russian. Russian spoken all over Central Asia because a lot of the countries and regions were part of the former Soviet Union. So I've realized how helpful it would be to speak Russian for the projects that we did because it's a language that's spoken in a lot of regions of the world, actually, from that. And then, yeah.
You know, it's funny. I have my own menu story. I didn't have a fire hydrant on my menu, but in Russian, I couldn't read the Cyrillic menu. So The English one offered a sandwich with language. Like, what could that possibly be? My curiosity get the best of me. What do you think it was?
I think it might have been like pepper or something like that. You know, like a hot pepper would be my thought. Like fire, hot, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, my sandwich with language turned out to be sandwich with tongue. So, for that one, once I knew what it was, the connection made sense because your mother tongue is the language that you speak, and they had tongue between bread.
Like an actual animal's tongue?
Well, like shaved tongue. So
of what animal?
Presumably cow? I didn't ask. The server just knew well enough to get me an English menu. If you try speaking the local language enough, you make all sorts of mistakes. I believe in another episode, I may have mentioned the time I accidentally called someone the bathroom because I didn't know how the syntax worked in that language, and I had like a week of Duolingo.
We try, that's all we could do.
Yeah, once again, be comfortable with being uncomfortable. That's how you get into the interesting parts of travel.
Absolutely.
I'm really curious about the work that you did with the RLC. It's just one of the, such an astounding man-made environmental disaster. But first, while we're talking about food, any interesting Caracal Pack food or drink?
I had horse.
Horse?
I had horse. It was served at the nice Italian restaurant, I think it was. Oh, what was it called? It was called Naples, I think. So I had horse. There's a horse steak. I had a bite from a coworker and it tasted just like steak. So that was probably one of the interesting things. I didn't have this in Uzbekistan, but in Kazakhstan, I had fermented horse milk. And I forgot what that's called. Yes.
Fermented horse milk.
Yup.
What's it taste like? I have to know.
It was really sour. It was tangy on your tongue, sour. I had just like a little shot. We didn't want to do a whole bunch, but we bought a bottle from a vendor. It's like known as like a drink and supposed to be kind of like fermented to be alcoholic, I think, or just kind of like kombucha, honestly. Yeah, but it was came out of like a 7-Up bottle.
Milky kombucha.
Yeah, I would say that. Like kind of how kombucha is kind of vinegary and tangy, and it was like that in the milk. Yeah, it was a sipper, not a guzzler. I will say that. And that was enough. And the fact that it came from a 7-Up bottle, I had just a little bit. I didn't want to test my stomach and my gut. And
so
I knew
an actual
regardless.
7-Up bottle.
Yeah, that was what it was fermented in.
Oh.
Yeah, it was just kind of off the side of a market at a touristy national park.
So this definitely isn't a mass-produced drink. You're not going to see ads on TV for fermented horse milk.
You will not. You will not. Oh, I wish I knew.
That's the kind of experience that you don't get when you stay with the tour group.
Exactly. And I was thankfully with people who like knew about it, like, oh, this is the national drink of Kazakhstan. And it's actually our translator in Uzbekistan who told us about, like, hey, what should we get? What should we try in Kazakhstan? He said this thing. And I forgot what it's called and I feel really bad about it. But that's the thing is a lot of people in Caracal Pakistan are ethnically Kazakh. So like they also speak Kazakh and go to school in Kazakhstan or things like that. So that's how we kind of had the connection to check it out. Otherwise, I wouldn't have sought it out.
Okay, I'm Googling this. Does the word kumis or kimis ring a bell?
Yes, kimis, I think.
Kimis. So those of you listening who are planning to travel to Kazakhstan, go to whatever farmer's market or stand by the side of the road selling these 7-Up bottles, or whichever bottles I presume are available. I've been to places where you'd find a little kiosk where the wine that you can get there is clearly something that the kiosk owner ferments in their basement using whatever bottles are available. Using old water bottles, 1.5-liter water bottles, where they took off the label and just filled it with whatever they were fermenting. And those are hit and miss. Some of it, there are some of the better wines I've ever had, also some of the worst wines I've ever had. And I'm wondering if, do you suppose there's a variety of kumis?
Hey, maybe like how people make it their own way, I could imagine, like fermentation time or I don't know much about horse breeds, and like maybe it depends on which horse you get from. They might have a different fat content. There's gotta be.
I'm just imagining some of the different flavors that people might add to kombucha, and they're adding it to this kumis, which I believe I just pronounced about 4 different ways. And
I can report back.
Diet cherry kumis.
Yeah, no, I don't know if they do like flavoring. It's like that, but.
Definitely curious to try that if I'm ever in that part of the world. And that part of the world is also, I believe you've told me before, the Soviet Union had a project to try to make that into a cotton-producing region. What happened there?
When the Soviet Union, they wanted to make it cotton a major product that was made in country versus imported, like from the United States, because this is pre-Cold War and kind of getting to those wanting to be self-sufficient. And so what they did is in the southern part of the Soviet Union, so the Central Asia region, there are two main rivers. One goes the Syrdarya that flows through mostly Kazakhstan, but it starts up in the mountains in Tajikistan. And another river that starts up there is the Amudarya, and that flows mostly through Uzbekistan. And so what they did in this region is these two rivers, they also both led to the Aral Sea. And the Aral Sea has no other incoming waters, and it's endorheic, meaning it doesn't have a drainage basin out. Like, this is just all the water goes there and it stays there.
Okay, kind of like the Great Salt Lake in the US, near Salt
Exactly.
Lake City.
Absolutely. Yes, that is
Or,
a great example. It is salty, though. The Aral Sea is a salty sea. And so the two rivers that fed the sea were diverted to flood the fields for cotton agriculture because you're in the middle of the desert. You need to irrigate somehow. You can't rely on rain and precip like you can in the Midwest, for example. And so so much of the water was diverted for this agriculture. And they also grew rice, but it was mostly cotton. Is that there was just not enough water that was going farther and farther downstream to fill the Aral Sea. And within the matter of a few decades, this sea, which was once the fourth largest inland body of water in the world, it reduced up to 90% by 90% in the matter of a few decades. So for
What?
me, that's
90%?
90%. That's taking like the surface water of like Erie and Ontario, because I'm a Great Lakes person, gotta put it in context, is that's the amount that disappeared, is the surface area of like Erie and Ontario. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's a lot
That's
of
a lot
water.
of water.
A lot of water. And so those rivers, they're still coming from the mountains, but there's the water's still being diverted for irrigation today, and like the floodplain just doesn't exist. Like, it just evaporates near the end.
So what happened to, let's say, the fish? And I guess there were probably villages along the sea that probably had fishing and other water-based activities, right?
Absolutely. So in both the Kazakhs, so the Aral Sea is partially in Kazakhstan and partially in Uzbekistan of modern day borders. And it was a huge fishing economy for both of the regions, the countries. There's a fishing port in the north and a fishing port in the south in Uzbekistan. And with the sea drying up, it also became extremely saline because of like the evaporation of water. I think you leave salt in the cup or like contact solution and the water evaporates and you left the salt at the bottom. So the water became extremely salty. And it was also full of pesticides because they used a lot of pesticides in the irrigation for the crops. And a lot of those pesticides eventually then flowed downstream, when the water was still flowing and concentrated that. And the fishing industry completely died off. So I think what was there was a canning factory in Moynak in Uzbekistan, and it was one of the largest fish canneries in all of the Soviet Union. And that completely disappeared. The fish disappeared to fuel that. So I'm like, that's a lot of fish. And so these communities were left with no resources. And that was like the thriving economy of the region, as well as supporting this agriculture. Now there's just not water and life to support that. So it's called huge environmental degradation in terms of these salts. Now they go in salt storms that also carry out the pollutants with the soils. And that
Salt
covers
storms?
salt storms. Yeah, you
Is
can look up a
that
picture
as
of
bad
it.
as I think it is?
Yeah, I couldn't find pictures online, but when we were there, we saw pictures of, there's one salt storm that went to the capital of Nukus, and you can actually see Landsat satellite imagery of it, of the salts blowing across, hundreds of kilometers, and it has covered the city in like a quarter inch of dust and completely killed the plants, because you know how salt can just suck up water out of things, and it decimated a lot of crops. So you're dealing with that in terms of environmental issues, but also health issues of inhaling these dusts and salts and pesticides. And so the health's a major concern in the region as well.
I think about how dry my throat gets if I just eat something that's too salty, and here you're exposed to it when breathing, probably. And also, there's the irony of knowing that this disaster was caused by a government trying to encourage agriculture, and as a result, by diverting water for agriculture, they ended up salting the earth.
Yeah, absolutely. And A lot of times for the agriculture too, is what they do is because it's so saline from all these dusts and stuff, is they'll use the irrigation canals from this river of the water that's still a little bit flowing, and they'll flood the field to try to wash off the salts. And so it's like they'll flood it and try to like rinse their field so they can plant each year. And that runoff goes back into the water and downstream, and that carries, those legacy contaminants and pesticides and all the things that further affecting the water quality and affecting health, which is a lot of the things that we're looking at right now. But to your point, it's not a foreign thing. Like, this is the same situation that's starting to happen at the Great Salt Lake.
When you're over there, is your role mainly to assess the damage and take data about the environment, or do you have a role with educating the public? And you're there with TIFO, right? Turfographics International Foundation.
Yeah, so I am a doing my graduate research with Terragraphics International Foundation, or TIFO, based in Moscow, Idaho. And they're a project with the ARLC in Uzbekistan. They have projects all over the world, but with this project in particular, and with actually all TIFO projects, they're all invitation only. So Doctors Without Borders, who's worked with TIFO on multiple projects around the world, asked TIFO to work doing an environmental health assessment in the Republic of Karakol, Pakistan, and Western Uzbekistan. And so before my time, the TIFO folks went over there and did some sampling of the environment, but they also saw that there was already existing sampling done by the regional government. They're like, oh, maybe we can look at that and kind of figure out what's going on over time and look at the health risks, because the goal at the end of the day is to understand the environmental health risks and develop intervention strategies to reduce health burdens on vulnerable populations. And so they saw this water monitoring sampling, and knowing that the regional government really wants to focus on addressing the water contamination in the region, because they have to truck in the water to some places and bottled water. People complain about the water being really salty or smelling bad or tasting bad just because it's so contaminated in that region, that the government really wants to do something about it. So that's why we are focusing our efforts on it, because we partner really close with the government and all of the TIFO projects. And so with addressing the water, we're looking at, they shared with us their historical water monitoring. And so that's what I'm going through right now for my research, is understanding, what they sampled for, when and where, between all the different districts and the water types, whether it's like a lake or drinking water or at the school or the water treatment plant, and trying to figure out understand what they sample for and what we can pull out from there to understand when and where the highest concentrations or most contaminated water is, so that we can target health intervention strategies there. Because you can't put like water treatment plants, in a country all over the place, right? And you can't put water back in the ARLC. As much as people ask that, it's identifying those targeted intervention strategies that are practical too for the regional folks. So that's where I come in and our role there.
Well, that's really cool and also kind of depressing that this kind of work is needed. So let's end on a happier note because we're coming up on time. You've built the foundations of a career where you get to travel the world and work in global health. What advice might you give to somebody who wants to be able to go out into the world and make an impact? How would they know which opportunities to look for and position themselves to best seize those opportunities to work at a global scale?
Absolutely. If you'd have asked me a year and a half ago from now that I would have traveled to Uzbekistan, let alone plans to go to Kazakhstan and Georgia this summer for more work, I wouldn't have believed you. But I think what really helped out was that global health field experience and saying, yeah, sure, Nepal sounds cool. I'm 19. I have no idea about the country or the region, but it sounds cool and something different. And so my advice would be just go for it. If your university, if you're a student, if your university has opportunities to do things like that and it interests you, importantly, just go for it and see what happens. The worst thing that happens is, you don't like to travel, but you won't know until you try. So there are also a lot of fellowships or a Peace Corps. Sometimes those stints can range different time lengths, or fellowships, teaching a different country, teach English. And I think just if you're thinking about it, do it, make it happen. It sounds like a long and scary commitment, but the experience is so fun and exciting that it flies by before you even know it'll happen, and you'll get so much out of it. So that's just my encouragement, is to be okay with going out of your comfort zone, because the worst thing that'll happen is that you'll grow from it.
That's amazing advice, and travel as a mechanism for growth is just a recurring theme on this show. I want to thank you for being on the show once again. It's been so insightful, and I'm really curious about that fermented horse milk now. And thanks to you for listening to the Near and Far podcast. If you liked this conversation, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your fellow explorers. You can find more episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, www.nearandfar.travel, YouTube, or wherever you enjoy your favorite podcasts. I'm your host, Zachary Ellis. Stay curious, stay adventurous, and stay exploring near and far.